Epilogue, 1976. What's happened since Black Like Me? The experiment that led to writing Black Like Me was done at the very end of 1959, before the first Freedom Rides or any other manifestation of national concern about racial injustice. It was undertaken to discover if America was involved in the practice of racism against black Americans. Most white Americans denied any taint of racism and really believed that in this land we judged every man by his qualities as a human individual. In those days, any mention of racism brought to the public's mind the Nazi suppression of Jewish people, the concentration camps, the gas chambers, and certainly, we protested, we were not like that. If we could not accept our somewhat different practice of racist suppression of black Americans, how could we ever hope to correct it? Our experience with the Nazis had shown one thing. Where racism is practiced, it damages the whole community, not just the victim group. Were we racists, or were we not? That was the important thing to discover. Black men told me that the only way a white man could hope to understand anything about this reality was to wake up some morning in a black man's skin. I decided to try this in order to test this one thing. In order to make the test, I would alter my pigment and shave my head, but change nothing else about myself. I would keep my clothing, my speech patterns, my credentials, and I would answer every question truthfully. Therefore, if we did, as we claimed, judge each man by his quality as a human individual, my life as a black John Howard Griffin would not be greatly changed, since I was that same human individual, altered only in appearance. If, on the other hand, we looked at men, saw the mark of pigment, applied all the false racial and ethnic characteristics, then, since I bore that mark, my life would be changed in ways I could not anticipate. I learned within a very few hours that no one was judging me by my qualities as a human individual, and everyone was judging me by my pigment. As soon as white men or women saw me, they automatically assumed I possessed a whole set of false characteristics. False not only to me, but to all black men. They could not see me or any other black man as a human individual because they buried us under the garbage of their stereotyped view of us. They saw us as different from themselves in fundamental ways. We were irresponsible. We were different in our sexual morals. We were intellectually limited. We had a God-given sense of rhythm. We were lazy and happy-go-lucky. We loved watermelon and fried chicken. How could white men ever really know black men if on every contact the white man's stereotyped view of the black man got in the way? I never knew a black man who felt this stereotyped view fit him. Always, in every encounter, even with good whites, we had the feeling that the white person was not talking with us, but with his image of us. But, white men would protest, they really are like that. I've known hundreds of them, and they're always the same. White men would claim black men were really happy. They liked it that way. And in a sense, such white men had good evidence for these claims, because if black men did not, in those days, play the stereotyped role of the good Negro, if he did not do his yessing and grinning and act out the stereotyped image, then he was immediately considered a bad Negro, called uppity, smart-alecky, arrogant, and he could lose his job, be attacked, driven away. White society had everything sewed up. If you didn't grin and yes, you were in deep trouble. If you did, then you allowed white America to go right on believing in the stereotype. People like Martin Luther King, they said, were just troublemakers and subversives. Whites told their black employees, and really believed it, that the NAACP and Martin Luther King were the black man's greatest enemies. They were offended by any suggestion of injustice. They claimed that they always treated black people wonderfully well, and always would, so long as black people stayed in their place. If you ask them what that place was, they could not really say, but every black man knew that place was right in the middle of the stereotype. Often they would face the black employee with this direct question: "Aren't you happy with your situation? Don't I treat you good?" If the black man had any hopes of remaining employed, he had to plaster that smile all over his face and agree. Once when I was employed at some menial job, I noticed that one of the white middle-aged bosses kept looking at me and getting more and more irritated. I could not imagine what I was doing wrong. Certainly I was sad, and that sadness must have shown, for finally he yelled at me,
"What's eating you, anyway?"
"Nothing," I said.
"Well, what are you so sullen about?"
he said. "Nothing," I repeated.
"Well, if you want to hang on to this job, you better show us some teeth."
And I did my grinning. In those days, the deepest despair hung over the lives of black people, a sense of utter hopelessness, for it seemed that no one in this country knew, or if they knew, couldn't care less, about this hopeless situation. Good whites, not the type that is overtly bigoted, urged us to
work, study, lift ourselves up by our bootstraps.
They really thought that was the remedy. They did not realize that every time black men thought they had found a loophole in the closed society, a way to accomplish this, that loophole was quickly plugged by the consent of all white society. For example, we did not see white-only signs on the doors of libraries, where we could find learning and books, but we knew we had better not try to enter one. We saw no white-only signs on the doors of schools or universities, but we knew it was suicidal to try to enter one. Above all, that good advice sounded hollow to us, because we knew that when men, even educated men, judged you by your pigment, it didn't matter how much you had worked, studied, or lifted yourself up. The PhD had to walk just as far to get food, water, or restroom facilities as the illiterate, and he could be turned away with the same base discourtesy. So the predominant feeling was one of hopelessness and despair.
"That white man is not going to let you have anything," black people said.
With the beginning of the freedom rides, the sit-ins, the display of heroic courage and commitment on the part of many who engaged in these activities, and with the rallying around Martin Luther King's philosophy of nonviolent resistance, that feeling of despair began to change into hope. Someone did know. Someone did care. Even white men showed concern. White people like the Marco brothers, Father John LaFarge, Lillian Smith, and others had long pioneered and suffered the fury of racist resentment. Newsmen like P.D. East and other white Southerners showed that the white man who advocated that this country live up to its promises to all citizens was no more free than any black man. Any white man who advocated justice in those days could be ruined by his white neighbors. This message did not get across to white America. Men kept thinking they were free and that these rabble-rousers were really getting what they deserved. Certainly many who had a sense of justice did not dare show it for fear of reprisals. So no one was free, and yet most lived under the delusion that they were free. Heaped on top of the economic reprisals and the dangers of physical reprisal was perhaps the most damaging reprisal of all: the deliberate character assassination that sprang into play the moment a man suggested that there ought to be equality among citizens, and this in a land where we claim equality as a first principle. How easy it was to destroy a man's good name and reputation by suggesting he was in some way subversive, or by calling him a communist. This got so bad that concerned people would come to me and say, "I'd like to speak out, but if I do, my neighbors will call me a communist." It got so bad that Lillian Smith wrote, "It's high time we stopped giving the communists credit for every decent, brave, considerate, and courteous act white men might show in regard to black men." I think the general public has never understood the special kind of life that civil rights advocates had to lead in those years. Racists showed high ingenuity in developing schemes to destroy a man's reputation as a means of nullifying his work. For example, many civil rights advocates, white and black, traveled and lectured extensively. In the early days, a number of effective men were entrapped in situations that either damaged them personally or ruined their reputations. Those who were with lecture bureaus were particularly vulnerable. Anyone could write the lecture bureau for the travel schedules of its speakers. If a man made a long flight to fulfill a speaking engagement, the chances were at least fair that when he landed at the distant airport, he might make use of the restroom. It would be enough to plant one or two men in the restroom and accuse him of some indecency. This happened to a Mississippi white attorney in a case that was given maximum publicity in white newspapers. He had to fly to Los Angeles for an appearance. His travel schedule was known. At the end of this flight, he went to the men's restroom, and when he emerged, he was arrested because two men claimed he had indecently exposed himself. He was tried in absentia and found guilty in Mississippi. He was publicly labeled a pervert, and his career in civil rights was effectively quashed. Priests openly involved in civil rights advocacy were menaced with rumors that they were immorally involved with women. An Oklahoma priest told me that one day after Mass, when he had given communion to a lady, she met him at the door of the church, gave him a hate stare, and said, "How's your woman, Father?" Priests are accustomed to being called by people in all kinds of distress. Another priest in the South told me a lady called him in distress because she could not understand a certain passage from Scripture and wanted to come right over and discuss it with him. He let her come, but when she made advances, he repudiated her and sent her away, fearing it was a scheme of racists to throw a woman rap at him. When Father John Caulfield became a public figure because he went into voluntary exile from his diocese in protest against the racial injustices condoned there, he was accepted into the Chicago Archdiocese. We feared that he would be victimized by character assassins, perhaps even entrapped into this kind of woman rap. I went to Chicago to brief him on the precautions he must take now that he stood as a symbol for civil rights, warning him that he must not be alone with any woman, that he must always be able to account for his time, so that no one could say he was at such and such a place at such and such a time. He and his host priests were quite dumbfounded. When I saw that they were not really going to believe that men would go to such lengths to vilify Father Caulfield, I called Dick Gregory, who happened to be at his home in Chicago. I told him my situation, and said I felt Father Caulfield would believe him if he would come over and add his warnings to mine. He came to the rectory, and we sat up and talked with the priests until 6 in the morning. He, of course, knew about Father Caulfield. He had heard the same rumors I had heard, that Father might be subjected to character assassination. Dick Gregory had already telephoned Chicago city officials and told them that if there was any attempt on the part of any racist group to smear Father Caulfield, Chicago's black citizens would block every freeway leading into the city and tie up Chicago until Father's name was cleared. We discussed this problem of character assassination and entrapment with Dr. King and Dick Gregory and Whitney Young and other men active in civil rights. We were advised by a black man in the government to take precautions. We should keep our travel schedules secret. We should avoid using public restrooms unless some reliable person accompanied us to serve as a witness in the event some plant might accuse us of some immoral act or gesture. We were advised never to get maneuvered into a situation where we were alone with any lady we did not know. In the bad days, we were even advised to find some pretext of changing our hotel rooms as soon as we registered. Civil rights workers risked being harassed in their hotel rooms. One minister, shortly after arriving at his hotel, answered a knock on his door and was beaten unconscious by two men wielding baseball bats. In my own case, if I stayed more than 3 days in any large city, I usually try to change hotels, or else move in with some black family. In one city in Louisiana where I lectured, I could not even stay in the city because all the lodging places had been threatened with bombings if they accepted me as a guest. This kind of thing continued throughout the early and mid-60s. We led strange, hidden lives. We were advocating only one thing, that this country rid itself of the racism that prevented some citizens from living as fully functioning men and, as a result, dehumanized all men. We were advocating only that this country live up to its promises to all citizens. But since racism always hides under a respectable guise, usually the guise of patriotism and religion, a great many people loathed us for knocking holes in these respectable guises. It was clear that we would have to live always under threat. When we would get together, with Dick Gregory, Martin Luther King, Sarah Patton Boyle, P.D. East, or any of the hundreds of more or less public advocates of civil rights, we compared notes and discussed this. One thing was clear. We had to accept the fact that these principles were worth dying for, and that there were plenty of people who were willing to see us disappear. In 1 year, we lost 7 friends and colleagues in death, of whom only one died a natural death. The others were killed. Dr. King and Dick Gregory became almost fatalistic in accepting the fact that they were dead men, and that it was only a matter of time before that fact became a reality. They and many, many others acted with a bravery and heroism almost incomprehensible to most men. They went into areas of extreme danger. This is possible occasionally, but it is almost impossible to keep it up. The human nervous system will not stand it. I got a glimpse of it up close one day in Chicago, when we learned that a black man had been found murdered in a town called Libertyville in Mississippi. In those days, you could only get an official version of such events. No black person would talk to you long distance for fear the operator was listening and would report the call. So the official version said simply that the victim, Mr. Lewis Allen, had been found shot. But since he had not been involved in civil rights, it was apparently just an ordinary killing. We did not believe it, so we decided to go there together and see what black people had to say about this. In those days, we worked such trips this way. We would fly into a nearby city, either Memphis or New Orleans. A Mississippi car, driven by black people, would pick us up and drive us to the area of trouble. We would get our answers as rapidly as possible and get gone. But even as we were making our arrangements, the nervousness overwhelmed us. There was some flaw in the planning. We called our contact again from the airport in Chicago. Dick Gregory wanted to make sure the pickup car would have someone he knew. I heard him shout into the phone, "I'm not going to get in a car with anybody unless I know who he is." By then we were both trembling. We were shaken with tremors of pure fear. When I mentioned this to Dick Gregory, he mumbled, "That's what we call knee-knocking courage." I suppose almost everyone in that kind of work had to learn a simple technique, to make our wills say yes, even when our bodies and our nervous systems said no. It is possible to go places and to function even when you are frightened. We discovered, incidentally, that although Mr. Allen was not involved in civil rights, as the officials stated, as though that were a good enough reason for getting killed, he had had the misfortune to witness a white man's attack on a black man and had been forced to testify to that in a court hearing the Wednesday before the Saturday on which he was found shot. In a sense, we led absurd lives in those days of terrible tensions. We formed a kind of loose confederation, without organization, exchanging information, helping one another. I deliberately did not belong to any organization. All of us, blacks and whites, were more or less in touch with one another and at the same time pretty independent. If something occurred in an area where one of us might be, particularly if it involved an injustice done to a black man, Whichever of us was closest to it tried to find out what had really happened and tried to help if possible. Because the Klan and Klan sympathizers were strong, we often stayed in the homes of brave black people. Often, when I was doing investigatory work in the South, I would travel with my old friend P.D. East, the white editor of the Petal paper, one of the heroes of early resistance to racism in his Southland. He was a comic genius who worked effectively by ridiculing the racists. He was broken, harassed, and impoverished because of this. But even in tragedy, he was irrepressibly funny. One day we were driving through a particularly disturbed area of the South, where the Klan was strong. We were very nervous for fear someone would recognize us. In those days, strange things happened. Police cars, for example, would simply get behind you and trail you so that you did not dare call on the person you intended to see for fear he would receive reprisals later. Filling stations, service stations were particularly adept at spotting suspicious persons and reporting them to the police or highway patrol. The police could stop you on any pretense. You were going too fast, or you had broken some law, and question you and harass you. Since so many of the lawmen were racists, it could be a nerve-wracking experience. I forget where we were going that day, but we were driving through a beautiful forest on a good highway, and I heard P.D. begin to curse under his breath. We were driving very carefully so as not to attract attention. I looked back and saw a police car, or perhaps a highway patrol car. In a moment, the car began to flash its dome flasher. We had to stop.
"Let me do the talking," P.D. growled.
"I won't open my mouth," I said. We waited, almost paralyzed with fright. Both of us were extremely hated in that particular area. The officer approached the driver's window of the car and asked P.D. where we were going. In a voice of humble cordiality, P.D. gave him some response. The officer replied with greater warmth, said we had made a turn back there without flashing the turning lights. Relieved that he apparently did not recognize us, we began testing the turning lights and found one of them did not work. He said he would not ticket us, but we should get it fixed at the next stop. P.D. thanked him profusely, and we drove on down the highway, watching in the rearview mirror to see that the patrol car was not following. It turned and headed in the opposite direction, and both of us heaved sighs of loud and profound relief.
"That was a close one, Griffin," P.D. said. "Did you see how cool I was in handling him?"
P.D. asked this brashly, in complete contrast to his mild and meek manner with the officer.
"You were great, P.D.," I said. "Let's hurry up and get out of this part of the country. The next one might recognize us."
He accelerated slightly, and we drove on in silence as I watched the tall trees flash past the car windows. Suddenly, P.D. exploded.
"Why, that ignorant son of a bitch! That insulting, ignorant son of a bitch!"
"What are you talking about, P.D.?" I asked.
"Do you realize that ignorant bastard didn't even recognize us? Hell, Griffin, we're famous, and he didn't even recognize us. I'm insulted."
"You'd better thank God he didn't."
"Well, I do thank God he didn't," P.D. said. "But that doesn't make it any less insulting."
In spite of everything, however, those days of the early and mid-60s were full of hope. The country seemed to be awakening to the depth of injustices suffered by black people. Hundreds of college students, white and black, poured into black areas to register black citizens for the vote. In areas outside of the South, students on campuses were deeply concerned and picketed local businesses that continued the practice of discrimination. These events became a matter for world news coverage. The world watched and mourned the bombings of Birmingham. The world watched, outraged and inspired by the events at Selma, enthralled by the Washington March. A major civil rights bill was passed in 1964, and if it was controversial, it at least nullified a lot of local discriminatory ordinances. This great surge of concern was important, but it was also deceptive. Many white civil rights advocates did not keep in close touch with the reality being lived by black Americans. For example, the noted Ralph McGill, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and editor of the Atlanta Constitution, did a major article for Look magazine in which he stated that the civil rights battle had been won. It was all over. Only a few die-hard bigots were left, he said. Everything was rosy. I was in Atlanta when that article hit the newsstands. McGill had been highly respected by black people. I visited several of the black scholars in the universities that day, including Dr. Benjamin Mays and Dr. Samuel Williams. All who had seen the article were stunned, embittered, and outraged by McGill's totally unrealistic and misleading statements. Stunned that a man of his impressive credentials could be so out of contact with truths that almost any black man could have told him. The truth is that if things looked beautiful to whites sympathetic to the movement, this was a surface appearance. What lay beneath the surface was another matter. It is true that hope and determination now largely replaced the old despair, and that was in itself a tremendous advance. But still, the problems of daily living for the vast majority of black men had not yet changed. Black people were still fired from their jobs for daring to register. Economic discrimination was rampant all over the land. The black press covered many events and developments that were never mentioned in the white press. To get anything like a full picture, you had to read the black press. It was revealing to see how few whites did. Again and again, in lectures to universities with good social science departments, where students were fired with enthusiasm for racial justice, I found that the school libraries, which took every newspaper and magazine published here and in Europe, did not have any subscriptions to black newspapers, scholarly journals, or magazines. We were already a land of two peoples, more of course, but we are concerned with two here, possessing two entirely different sets of information, and we were out of touch with one another. The situation was doubly dangerous because we thought we were, finally, communicating. We were not, of course, because even well-disposed white men tended to be turned off and affronted if black men told them truths that offended their prejudices. For years it was my embarrassing task to sit in on meetings of whites and blacks to serve one ridiculous but necessary function. I knew, and every black man there knew, that I, as a man now white once again, could say the things that needed saying, but would be rejected if black men said them. In city after city, we had these meetings to attempt to communicate, and in each one, my function was to say those things that the black men knew much better than I could hope to know, but could not communicate as yet for the simple reason that white men could not tolerate hearing them from a black man's mouth. Dick Gregory and I once made an experiment with this. We agreed to say essentially the same things to a lecture audience at the same school. I got an ovation for talking straight. He got uncomfortable silence for saying the same things. Another time, this was eloquently illustrated in a small community where there had been much tension between Protestants and Catholics. A professor of Bible at a local college persuaded the two groups to get together and sponsor a lecture by me. I went in and lectured precisely on these problems of communication. I went into it in great detail. The audience, as always, thought I was talking about somewhere else and was sure it was different there. At the end, I got a prolonged standing ovation. Afterward, I went to a reception for the whites who had promoted the lecture and one black guest. We were introduced. I was told in his presence just how proud the community was of its black industrial psychologist and how he had gained acceptance in the most perfect way. The professor of Bible who had initiated the project was jubilant. He remarked loudly what a great success it was and how marvelous that the Protestants and Catholics had finally worked together to make it a success. "I view this as a historic night," he announced. Then turning to the black industrial psychologist, he asked, Don't you see this night as a historic turning point for this community? The black doctor, in a voice of perfect calm, replied, Frankly, I'm not too excited. The Bible professor's face clouded, and he said, What do you mean? The doctor said, It's true that I have a good job in this town, and I seem to be respected, and I am certainly paid a wage commensurate with my skills. But, so long as I have to house my wife and children in a town 20 miles away, because I can't buy, rent, lease, or build a home here, don't expect me to get too excited over your historic turning points. I watched, fascinated, as the group of whites began to growl, and the professor of Bible reddened with anger. Well, I'll tell you one thing, he said. If you're going to be that cynical, I don't see how you can expect us to do anything for you. I heard a local minister mumble to a lady standing beside him, I knew there'd be trouble if we invited that black man. The Bible professor lost most of his self-control. He battered at the lack of graciousness and courtesy that he perceived in the black doctor. The doctor remained calm, lethal in his replies, unshaken. I watched until the professor was almost screaming his anger and then stepped in. Isn't this remarkable? I said. Here you gave me a standing ovation for telling you this same kind of truth. Now you have a black man, far more knowledgeable than I could be, who is honoring you with a truth, and you are furious with him. You will hear it from me and applaud me for saying it, but you can't stand it yet from him. The point was finally made, but I doubt if it would ever have been made if that doctor had not been invited and had not spoken up. Almost constantly and almost everywhere, black men were being faced with this kind of duality. Whites were saying the right things, showing deep concern over injustices, expressing determination to resolve the problems of racism, but never really consulting with black people as equals. The vast difference between what this country was saying and apparently believing and what the black man was experiencing was embittering. As a person who lived almost constantly in both communities, I could foresee nothing but trouble. Frequently, in cities where racial difficulties surfaced, I was called in by perfectly sincere community leaders, usually mayors or college presidents or city council members. They wanted me to study their situation and report to them on it. First, I would have meetings and be briefed by white men, often by trained white social scientists. Then I would be taken into the black community, where again I would be briefed by black leaders and sometimes black social scientists. In no city did these two briefings coincide. In St. Louis, Rochester, Detroit, Kansas City, Los Angeles, and many others this occurred. In every city there was this different view of the same situation by perfectly sincere men. I always pointed out the irony in this. I was being called into an area I did not really know. Why not ask local black leaders directly the kind of questions the cities were asking me? After the first difficulties in Rochester, New York, I was asked to consult with community leaders. I went and spoke for quite a long time. The leaders were concerned and sincere men. The first question one of them asked after I talked was, Well, Mr. Griffin, what is the first thing we should do now? I told him that I had been asked to come and consult with community leaders, and yet I was sitting in a room full of white men. Rochester is full of knowledgeable black men. The white man who had asked the question slapped his forehead in real chagrin. It never occurred to me to ask any of them, he said apologetically. So you see what's happening, I said. Black men are going to know about this meeting. I have already consulted with many black men locally, because that's the way I get my information. See how it looks from their point of view. You have brought me a long distance to consult with community leaders about a problem that profoundly involves black men in this community, and yet no black man was invited. I warned them that this kind of thing was interpreted by black men as part of the hopeless lack of understanding on the part of white men, and that they must be careful to invite men the black people considered leaders, not just a few black men that the business and community leadership considered leaders. Later, I got a call from one of the white leaders who asked, "How do we go about finding black leaders whom the black people would respect as leaders?" "Ask black people. Ask a lot of black people," I advised. This kind of pattern existed almost everywhere. I would be called in. Often, in the presence of local black men, whites would ask me questions that should have been addressed to the black men present. They knew the community. I didn't. Always, this was an affront to black men, one of the many affronts that white men apparently could not perceive. What it really told black men was that we had better buckle down and garner the superior problem-solving abilities of white men to get this thing settled. This is one of the attitudes that led black men to believe that racism was so deeply ingrained in the white man there was really no hope of his ever understanding. This was an attitude, too, which did not inspire one bit of confidence in black men who saw problems affecting their very lives being handled by white men who did not even consult with black men. So while on the surface things looked good and promising to white men, and I was always being urged to admit that great progress had been made, resentments grew among black people, and quite particularly among educated black people. Black spokesmen like Dr. King, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, James Farmer, Dick Gregory, Stokely Carmichael, and many others warned that the inner cities were becoming powder kegs and would certainly explode. In every city I was brought in to study, and often I returned again and again, I would live in the black ghetto with black families, and I would come out and give the most detailed analysis to the whole city and to community leaders, warning them that black resentments and frustrations were explosive, and that one day some little insignificant event would occur and produce an explosion that would astound the whole community. In every city, the local community leaders who had brought me in nevertheless felt that they lived there and knew better, and said that I was being unduly pessimistic. In some cities, I was called unduly pessimistic only weeks before the explosions occurred. And when those cities exploded into turmoil, men who had not believed me would telephone to tell me I had been right and they had been wrong. "I wish I had been wrong," was all I could answer. One of the strange things was the resentment people showed when you gave such warnings. The warnings were seen as threats. Often I was accused, as were even Dr. King and Dick Gregory, of advocating violence. This is like accusing a doctor of advocating the very cancer he is trying to prevent from spreading. But somehow people could not face what appeared inevitable, and they sought to evade it by viewing these warnings as threats. And when the matches were tossed and the powder kegs began to explode in 1967, men hid behind the belief that it was all some massive, subversive plot against this nation. The Kerner Commission was established and asked to investigate. Its report, which was a courageous one under the circumstances, showed that matches had indeed been tossed and the powder kegs had exploded, and that these were individual explosions, not connected through any discernible subversive plotting on the part of black men. The commission report warned that massive displays of force in so-called riot control was one of the deepest sources of resentment and could trigger off more riots. The report was an obvious disappointment to some of our leaders, who had really counted on it to reveal massive subversion, so they simply cast its recommendations aside with the remark, "The report blamed everyone but the rioters." Black spokesmen countered by saying that to blame the rioters would be like blaming the powder keg that exploded. This was perhaps the most terrible time in modern history insofar as civil rights were concerned in this land. Black people began to believe in greater numbers that this country was really moving toward genocide, and from the point of view of black America, the evidence was alarming. That year, in President Johnson's State of the Union message, His appeals for social justice and civil rights met with absolute silence from Congress. Not a single lone hand clap of approval broke that silence. His appeal for saving the California redwood trees, which followed immediately, got an ovation of wild hand-clapping approval from Congress. The message was clear and desolating. It showed this country's priorities and mood. It said to every black man, "Save the redwood forests, and to hell with you." In my dismay, I wired the president, "I'm tired of being a loser. From now on, I'm going to forget humanity and work for the trees." The patterns of the exploding inner cities began to emerge. From the black man's viewpoint, it often looked as though black people were being driven to a flare-up, which would then justify suppression by white men on the grounds of self-defense. In those terrible days of open conflict, I was being taken into the inner cities, usually by black militants, as an observer. I hardly ever opened my mouth. The day was past when black people wanted any advice from white men. I was taken in simply to view it from the inside, so that in the event we did come to open genocidal conflict, there would be someone to give another view to history. And another view I got. I attended enraged meetings where black men, women, children, students discussed their experiences. Everyone was saying the turmoil was the work of young blacks. This was not true. Middle-aged and elderly black people attended those meetings everywhere and burned with rage. In Wichita, Kansas, I heard a young college student say the kinds of things that were being said in all the cities. He recounted an injustice done him in that community. He showed wounds where he had been beaten by white men.
"We've tried everything decent," he said loudly. "Yes," the audience responded. "Yes, who can doubt that? We asked for justice and they fed us committees," he shouted. "Yes, they've even got committees to decide how much self-determination we're going to have. Take 10, someone shouted from the back of the room. "Take 10, a few responded. After he had spoken, the young man came over to my chair, almost sobbing with frustration. He looked into my eyes with eyes that were wild with anguish, and whispered while we shook hands,
"When you go back, will you do me a favor?"
"Yes, if I can," I said.
"When you go back out there, will you tell your friend Jesus Christ and your friend Martin Luther King? Shit!"
He spat out the word with the deepest despair I have ever heard in a human voice. On the streets, young black men would call out, "Take 10! To one another. Whites thought they were talking about a 10-minute coffee break. What they were really saying was that this country was moving toward the destruction of black people, and since the proportion was 10 whites to every black, then black men should take 10 white lives for every black life taken by white men. Certainly the news reports and coverage, given largely by white interpreters outside the ghettos and widely and sincerely believed by horrified whites, had no credibility within the ghettos because they did not coincide with what black men were experiencing. And in the heat of emotions, few white men could penetrate the troubled areas, and the media had not yet hired many black reporters who could have given a more balanced view. As black men began to compare notes with me around the country, a strange pattern began to emerge. If it did not hold true for all the exploding communities, it held true for many of them. In these, someone in a high place, the mayor, chief of police, or other official, would receive information that a neighboring city was already in flames and that carloads of armed black men were coming to attack this city. This happened in Cedar Rapids when Des Moines was allegedly in flames. It happened in Ardmore, Oklahoma, and in Fort Worth, Texas, when it was alleged that Oklahoma City was in flames and carloads were converging on those two cities. It happened in Reno and other western cities when Oakland, California was supposed to be in flames. It happened in Roanoke, when Richmond, Virginia was supposed to be in flames, and in many other communities. In no instance were these reports true, or were any of these cities actually in flames. But the result was immediate action on the part of the white officials. They got in contact with important community and industrial leaders. Riot control measures were ordered into effect. Civilians armed themselves for the coming attack and stationed themselves at strategic points. In most cases, many whites became aware of the danger, and no local black person had any idea of what was going on, though I recall one case where the rumor spread through a West Coast community, and a white official called a young black teacher with whom he was friendly. He told the black teacher about the report and asked him to look around the neighborhood and see if anything suspicious was going on, any preparations for battle. The young black man went and looked and returned to the phone.
"It looks pretty sinister," he said. "There's a lady across the street putting her baby in the stroller, and down the block I saw a man mowing his lawn. You'd better take proper precautions."
In most cases, however, black people were quite unaware that a storm was brewing. Then, when the riot controls had been put into effect, and a nervous white population was waiting, it took little to set it off. In Wichita, a few white youths drove down into the black area and simply fired off guns. This brought black people out of their houses. In rage at seeing the harassment, they hurled stones or sticks at the passing car, and the battle was on. In that particular instance, the police arrested the 5 whites who were armed and 12 young black men who had only rocks and sticks. All were jailed. The next morning, all were released on bail, but the bail set for the 5 armed whites was only 1/5 the amount set for the 12 unarmed black students. This kind of overt inequity in bonding spread its message to the black community, and when no whites protested, or even seemed to find it unjust, black people saw that as highly significant too. In other cities, it was enough to throw rocks on the porches of black people to bring them out and for the confrontation and the madness to occur. Some cities were saved. Variants of this rumor-mongering set off other cities. Who was doing this? I don't suppose anyone really knows. White people were sure it was traveling black agitators who came in and exploded the community from within. Black people viewed this as an open lie, since the explosions occurred from outside the ghettos. Also, they were not seeing any traveling black agitators, at least until after the explosions had happened. And certainly, no one had to come in and stir up resentments among black people in 1967. These resentments were open and raw already. And not a single one of these cities, where the hundreds of carloads of armed blacks were supposed to be converging, did any of these cars show up. How did it happen, black people asked, that white people did not notice this and repudiate the pattern of rumor? In Davenport, Iowa, officials were informed that a busload of armed black men were coming in from Washington. The police alerted civic leaders and went to meet the bus. There was indeed a busload of black people from Washington, but they were not armed. They were teachers on tour. Again, we had the duality of viewpoint regarding who was actually implementing these patterns of tension, rumor, and explosion. Black people were absolutely certain it was not black people, and it was generally feared it might be some white racist group, and therefore another symptom of genocidal manipulation. I traveled from city to city in those days, and the view from within the ghettos was terrible and terrifying. While white people in the periphery were arming themselves against the day when they would have to defend themselves from attack by blacks, and really believed someone was fomenting a racial war in which black people would rise up and attack them, black people mostly without arms huddled inside the ghettos, feeling that they were surrounded by armed whites. Black parents tried to keep a closer watch on their children. Black men spoke of the old licensed bloodlust, which allowed racists to do anything to black people and get away with it. Local white leadership was discredited in the eyes of black people, too, by their insistence on asking me, when we met to discuss the local events, usually with black people, if I had discovered who was the traveling black agitator who had come in and stirred up their good black people. And had I discovered if there were any communists behind the disruptions? Black people just could not believe local white officials, who surely must be aware of local conditions, could really think the explosion had been caused by outside agitators or communists. And the white officials were viewed as completely insincere. Sadly enough, I knew the white officials really and sincerely did believe the causes lay elsewhere than in their own backyards. During the Miami Republican Convention of 1968, because the media had black reporters who could get into the black area, even in crisis times, this whole nation saw the making of a riot unfold before them on TV screens. They saw the unwarranted police raids on black political caucuses because these caucuses refused to allow white reporters. They saw a curfew that was ordered in the afternoon when most black people were at work or did not have their radios on. They saw that curfew really being made known for the first time to most black people that evening, when law enforcement men rolled into the black areas, unleashed a cloud of tear gas, and only then announced on their portable speakers that a 6 p.m. curfew had been ordered and all people should return to their homes and stay inside. After that series of provocations, the city exploded into a riot. The country saw it, got a good and expert report on it. The commentators even mentioned the fact that it was very hot and that people were cooling themselves outdoors, since there was little or no air conditioning in the dwellings of that part of the city. And yet within hours, one of the state's top officials blandly announced that they were looking for the communists and black outside agitators who had caused it. Presumably, they never found them. Black people who had witnessed this all over the country could only despair at the gullibility of white people who, seeing all this, swallowed the old line that it was caused by communists and black agitators. 3 weeks before the assassination of Martin Luther King, I met on the West Coast with a group of black leaders to compare notes. Almost simultaneously, many black people had become convinced that every time a black community was goaded into such an explosion, it served only the cause of racists and brought us closer to a genocidal situation. The word went out not to let racists goad the communities into flare-ups. This is certainly one of the reasons why Dr. King's murder did not unleash massive violence, as might have been anticipated. There were, of course, scattered pockets of retaliatory violence in some of the eastern cities and Washington, D.C., but it was not the all-out race war that it could have been. What reconciliation was possible, then? If whites looked on blacks with distrust, it was nothing compared to the vast distrust with which blacks regarded whites. Almost ironically, the person of Martin Luther King in life and in death became the touchstone for a whole new evaluation among black thinkers. This evaluation led to alternatives to violent confrontation. So, in a bizarre sense, Dr. King, who had seemed so defeated and who had died without much hope that his philosophy of nonviolent resistance had accomplished anything, became the mainspring for a whole new way of thinking among black people, and in the long run, averted violent head-on collision between the citizens of this country. As a result of this new thinking, the Take 10 call faded. Black men began to see other ways out. A whole new dynamism was put into play at the time of Dr. King's martyrdom. Up until that time, black thinking had been focused on the dream of an integrated society as the ultimate solution to discrimination and racial injustice. It was a dream held also by many whites, a dream for which many whites and blacks had already died. This dream was so deep, so cherished, and seemed to be such an unqualified good that no one really questioned it. It took men of great mental toughness to begin to ask if that dream had not carried in its wake certain weaknesses for the black American. When this painful line of thought was opened up, it became apparent that at least some of that dream had kept black men weak. For example, if a black man set up a business, he might very well hear his black potential clients say, "After all this struggle for integration, I'm not going to self-segregate," and refuse to patronize his business. Also, it was generally believed, though the belief was fading, that most good whites lived in the North and most bad whites lived in the South. Certainly many northern cities deplored what was going on in the South. But when Martin Luther King, who had been so praised in the North for the work he did in the South, came to work in the cities of the North, the very officials who had praised him sometimes led opposition to his work locally. This revealed to black people that there was no basic difference between attitudes in the North and South. A white-imposed separation had always existed in both areas. Dr. King's trips into the North show that even in the friendliest cities, there would always rise up out of the local community sufficient opposition to prevent bridging this separation. It became bitterly apparent that this separation was going to go on existing into the foreseeable future. What then? Black leaders and thinkers began to stand back and review the situation. Their conclusions were harsh. The old dream and the constant hope for one solution, that of an integrated society, had not worked and had little chance of working now. Black people were jammed together in ghettos and were going to have to stay there. All the apparent progress had not changed the problems of black people living in the ghettos of this land. Black men were still not able to function as men, as leaders of their households, as self-determining and self-respecting human individuals. What were the possible alternatives to these exhausting and violent cycles of hopes built up and then dashed through the moods of white society? Black leaders pondered. They must find the genius to turn a seemingly hopeless situation into an advantageous one. The first step was to accept the realities of the situation and act on them rather than on some nebulous dream of a future when all men would come to the realization that racial justice was for the good of all society, not just for the good of the oppressed. Once viewed from this perspective, some startling facts became clear. Black thinkers, discarding the old dream, began to expose the weaknesses that had been built into the system. The first of these weaknesses was called fragmented individualism by the philosophers. As soon as it was defined, it was understood by black people and recognized. What fragmented individualism really meant was what happened to a black man who tried to make it in this society. In order to succeed, he had to become an imitation white man. Dress white, talk white, think white, express the values of middle-class white culture, at least when he was in the presence of white men. Implied in all this was the hiding, the denial of his selfhood, his negritude, his culture, as though they were somehow shameful. If he succeeded, he was an alienated, marginal man, alienated from the strength of his culture and from fellow black men, and never able, of course, to become that imitation white man because he bore the pigment that made the white man view him as intrinsically other. The instant the term fragmented individualism was understood, it was completely understood by black men who had lived it in all its nuances. And as soon as it was understood, black men could do something positive to counter it. The brother and sister concept swept in. Black people deliberately stopped trying to imitate white men in dress, speech, and etiquette. Black men reversed the weaknesses of fragmented individualism by studying black history, developing black pride, even using words like black, which had been oppressive before, hammering them home until they stood for the symbol of the new black and became beautiful. Black thinkers spoke of turning the ghettos into gardens, taking over their own schools, building a nation within a nation. They pointed out the economic weaknesses of the old system. Most businesses in black areas were owned by white men, particularly the big chain grocery stores. Black people were shown that their dollars lost strength when spent in those stores because the profits went into white banks, which would not discriminate against black people for TV and car loans, but would discriminate against them for small business or housing loans. With this understanding, black people in Chicago began to make the rounds of such stores, saying in effect that if the stores expected to sell another leaf of lettuce to black people, the stores had to hire black personnel, including black people at management level, and furthermore, they had to bank the proceeds of that particular ghetto operation in black banks, which would not discriminate against black people in loans. The stores had to comply, and this was so successful in Chicago that the techniques spread across the country. At more personal levels, it began to be understood, and was then quickly understood, that black society must work to salvage the black male child. Always before, there had been concern for the black girl child. It was now pointed out that the black male child, even at a black school using white textbooks, could early come to the conclusion that all the heroes in history were white men. Furthermore, with the exception of nationally known black civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King, Roy Wilkins, James Farmer, and others, the black male child frequently saw the adult black male as ineffectual and defeated. The old picture of the white man leading the black man by the hand toward the solution to his problems again gave the black male child a view of the adult black male as something not worth becoming, and killed his spirit and his will to become an adult, problem-solving individual. This perception swept the nation. Black parents began to demand changes in textbooks and to demand that black people be visibly involved in the solutions to all problems that concerned them. A few white men who had worked long and hard in civil rights saw the immense importance of this new perception. Men like Saul Alinsky and Father James Groppi and others, who were regarded as heroes of the civil rights movement, began to fade from public view, although continuing to work privately. They felt, as many blacks now felt, that for the sake of that black male child, black men should be seen as the problem solvers and leaders, and that whites should stay out of the spotlight. Some whites, who had never really understood, were offended by this sudden death of their role as the good white leading the poor black out of the jungle. Many of these were among the saddest people of our time, good-hearted whites who had dedicated themselves to helping black people become imitation whites, to bringing them up to our level, without ever realizing what a deep insult this attitude can be. White perception of these rapid changes in black concepts lagged. Whites in general could not keep up with the progress of black thinking. It was fascinating and tragic to see so many whites who had given long years to civil rights work suddenly excluded from the thinking of black men. Black students were particularly aware that they had to give the black child a view of black men standing on their own and to erase all hints of the old view of being led by whites. College students formed black student unions and excluded white students. Few white students understood. White college students, after all, had been one of the great bulwarks in the battle for racial justice, and many had dedicated themselves heroically to this cause. But part of that incipient racism had always led whites to assume the leadership positions and perpetuated the view that whites rather than blacks were the heroes of the movement. Really sincere and informed whites were thanked for what they had done and advised to go and work in their own communities to combat the racism there, which could ultimately be as oppressive to non-racist whites as to blacks. Some did this and continue to do it, though it is perhaps more onerous than working with blacks. The same principle held in black universities, where students demanded more and more black teachers. White professors, who had virtually dedicated their lives and their academic careers as historians, anthropologists, sociologists to the problems of racism and its cures, thinking they did this for the good of the oppressed victims of racism, and often suffering social and academic insults as a result, were asked to leave schools in favor of black teachers. Some of them turned very bitter. Some who were eminent authorities in their disciplines and were recognized as such by black authorities in the same disciplines were told by students that their work was not relevant because they were not black. To have one's life's work dismissed in such a frivolous manner by people who have never yet studied it was a severe insult. One elderly scholar, who had been a thundering advocate of civil rights, now speaks of those black punks. Another, a sociologist, still involved in the study of discrimination in medicine and medical schools, recently told a professor at a California medical school who was proud of the achievement of black medical students there, "Well, I hope when you get sick you call one of them." Such men, deeply offended to be excluded from participation with black men in the solutions to the problems of racism, sometimes begin to look for symptoms of inferiority as a means of self-defense. We are seeing a recrudescence of these contentions by scientists, even to the recent suggestion that men with lower IQs, by white-oriented tests, be paid to have vasectomies, $1,000 for each point lower than 100, so that a man with an IQ of 90 would get $10,000 to have himself sterilized. This has been viewed as another example of genocidal thinking. All of this is part of the current scene. Some people call it polarization, and many of us, white and black, still remember the days of the early and mid-60s when we were all working together, singing, "We Shall Overcome," and thinking that success was just around the corner. But now, though we can still bungle into fratricide, there is really more hope than in the past. In the past, hope was based on the moods of the majority, a fragile and slippery basis. That is gone now, and a realism, harsh, full of contradictions, has replaced it as something more solid on which to build, a basis which says that black people will continue to move toward being fully functioning and self-determining people. And this is irreversible. Polarization. Separation. No one has wanted this, white or black. It has come because the things we dreamed of did not materialize. Many still hold the old dreams, even while accepting today's realities. A couple of years ago, I was seated in an auditorium in Detroit, where Reverend Klieg was explaining to a conference of priests that what they called black separatists were in reality men who recognized the implacability of a white-imposed separation. Afterward, one of the priests got up and asked, "But aren't you advocating an un-Christian way? The way of accepting as a reality this white-imposed separation? You are a minister. Are not all of us who are ministers obligated to bring men together in love?" "Yes," Reverend Klieg said. "And because you have not preached that long enough and loudly enough, we are faced with accepting the separation." Eventually, some black thinkers believe, this separation may be the shortest route to an authentic communication at some future date, when blacks and whites can enter into encounters in which they truly speak as equals, and in which the white man will no longer load every phrase with unconscious suggestions that he has something to concede to black men or that he wants to help black men overcome their blackness. You have been listening to Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin and read by Ray Childs. This production includes an epilogue to Black Like Me, written by the author in 1976. For more information about this or any other audio bookshelf production, call 1-800-234-1713, go online to audiobookshelf.com, or write to 174 Prescott Hill Road, Northport, Maine, 04849. Black Like Me, copyright John Howard Griffin, 1960, 1961, 1977. Copyright renewed Elizabeth Griffin Bonazzi, Susan Griffin Campbell, John H. Griffin, Jr., Gregory P. Griffin, and Amanda Griffin Sanderson, 1989. Recorded by arrangement with New American Library, a division of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2004, Audio Bookshelf. Copying this production for any reason is strictly forbidden.